We had a presidential election in Russia and Putin won more than 87% of the votes. What was the message of this election for the West, in your opinion?
There wasn't a message for the West. It was a purely internal matter for the Russian population. And it was a referendum on Putin's governance, on his performance in office and his plans. And the Russians wholeheartedly approve of both of those. And therefore, they voted for him in droves. It is also representative of the very high spirits of the Russian population, which is very optimistic about the course of the country, and is very much unified because they see military victory over the West, which is something that they very much want.
When you look at Macron's behavior during the recent 2, 3 weeks, it's so strange to find what this guy is talking about. How does the Putin administration feel about this type of behavior on the part of Europeans?
I think that basically there isn't a great deal of interest in having anything to do with the Europeans at this point. They can pretty much do whatever the hell they want as long as they stay out of Russia's way. And you know, there was for a time in the 1990s an effort on the part of the Russian government and the Russian population to integrate into Western Europe. As a result of that, the Russians have realized what Western Europe and the United States are and have lost all interest in integrating with them or having much of anything to do with them. So that now they're basically looking for new friends and partners elsewhere and are finding them. And the entire world is flocking to Russia in search of new partnerships that are not exploitative, but more on an equal footing.
In his talk right after the election, he said that I dream of a strong, independent, and sovereign Russia. In your opinion, how much of this has already been achieved by Putin and his administration during these years that they have been in power in Russia?
I think that he's already achieved a great deal, and now he's on a path of making specific improvements to roads and railways and hospitals and schools and maternity wards and better living accommodations for the Russians and development of various provincial cities and a great deal of stuff like that. But it's all development and improvement. There isn't really any significant existential problem to solve. The last significant existential problem was in getting rid of the West as a dependency for the Russian economy, and that has been achieved to a great extent already.
What was the main reason behind this huge participation on the part of Russians? This victory over Ukraine was the main reason, or the population is feeling that the West is not on their side?
Well, the situation in the Ukraine has certainly caused the Russian population to unify. And also, it has been exposed to Western propaganda directed against Russia. And this has basically cemented the view in the public's mind that the West is the enemy. It's not. Most Russians do not see the Ukrainians as the enemy. Most Russians don't even see the Ukrainians as Ukrainians. They just see them as fellow Russians who have lost their way. And this is something that needs to be remedied that will take decades. But the real enemy is the West, and the absolute realist enemy is the United States. And so the country is unified as never before around the goal of perhaps not defeating this enemy because the United States is fading fast without any Russian action, but basically getting rid of the United States in Russia's mind space, if you will, basically severing the Russian civilization from the Western civilization that is that has been dominated by the United States.
What are the new challenges that Putin would face in this new era?
Well, I think the biggest problem for Russia is basically, you know, not basically, but essentially realizing that it is not alone. The Russian mentality is very much a go it alone mentality. The often repeated statement that Russia only has two allies, the army and the navy, the Russian army and the Russian navy. Everyone else is either a stranger or an enemy. But Russia really does have a lot of friends around the world. It's just that none of the Western countries qualify. Even some Western countries are sort of neutral, like Hungary is relatively neutral. Serbia wants to be a friend, but it's weak and surrounded by NATO. As far as the rest of the world, it views Russia's role in standing up to the West as nothing short of heroic, and Russia needs to set aside its natural mistrust and embrace these new possibilities for forming real friendships with countries around the world. That process is pretty far along with certain countries, with China certainly, with Iran. But the level of interest in that the various countries have in joining BRICS has to do with more than anything else, I would say, with Russia's stance in its very forceful decoupling from the Western financial and economic realm. And everybody else wants to basically follow along in that path. So that is a big challenge for Russia. Another big challenge is that there's a labor shortage in Russia, skilled labor. Russia has access to an almost infinite number of basically manual laborers from the Central Asian republics, which still have very high birth rates and can produce lots of able-bodied roustabouts, if you will, who can work on construction sites. Not so good in a factory setting. Quite a lot of them aren't really literate enough to operate complicated machinery or anything like that. Some of them are trainable, though. But Russia really has to take advantage of this surplus of qualified unemployed people in the West and somehow figure out a way to absorb them into Russia. The current system that is in place for having specialists get work visas in Russia is very difficult to work for both companies and individuals. And so Russia has to figure out a way to streamline and simplify the bureaucracy, which is very resistant to change, to make immigration more possible, or, you know, basically make it easier, make it flow better. So that's another huge challenge that Russia has. And, you know, finally, there is the challenge of absorbing a large chunk of former Ukraine. A lot of the people who used to live in what was the Ukraine for 30 years are very eager to become good, hardworking, taxpaying, patriotic Russians. And that was obvious in the massive voter turnout in the new Russian regions of Novorossiya. And in Crimea. But the process is going to become a little bit more difficult as Russia absorbs other Russian regions, which is likely to happen in the coming months and years. So I see that as another huge challenge. Finally, there's a number of institutions that Russia is in one way or another involved in, such as international scientific collaborations. Just recently, it was in the news that 500 physicists have been basically told that they can't work at CERN in Switzerland anymore. I myself at one point worked there. This is basically CERN shooting itself in the foot because these Russian institutions provided a great deal of not just knowledge, but actual equipment that CERN needs to operate its very complicated and expensive experiments. So this will set science back. But on the plus side, Russia has very similar projects under development or very far along. And it certainly looks forward to having these 500 physicists come back and work for Russia instead of working for this international collaboration that no longer wants them. But there are other similar problems like that. Basically, a lot of disciplines have to be de-Westernized, in particular finance and economics. There's a great number of specialists in Russia that have been trained in the West in finance and economics, and obviously they were trained wrong. And they need to be retrained to embrace a new way of doing things more similar to what China has been doing.
Putin said that before this war started, more than 54% of Russian trades were in dollar. Right now, it's less than 13%. How much does it take to get totally independent?
Oh, I don't think Russia needs to become totally independent. It still sells various key commodities to the West for dollars or for euros, and will continue doing that. And it still buys certain things from the West. And I think that is going to continue. The whole point is to make it not just to prevent the use of dollars altogether, but to make it impervious to any sort of currency market-based attack. And that has already happened to a great extent. So now, nobody in the West can do anything really to significantly hurt Russia economically or financially. It has achieved a sufficient level of independence financially. And that's the goal, not just getting rid of every last dollar. As far as the overall shift, you see before, a great deal of money in the form of dollars mostly was leaving Russia in the forms of people's savings being invested offshore, or dividends paid by Russian companies with foreign participation, with foreign shareholders. And that has been stopped because nobody really trusts all of these offshores or Western banks, because everybody knows now that the right of private property is no longer respected in the West. Money can just disappear from your bank account or be frozen. And nobody trusts to do business that way, financial business with the West. So basically that problem has pretty much fixed itself. There's still foreign ownership of Russian companies, but the dividends are paid in rubles into a Russian bank account. They don't leave the country. So the foreigners have to reinvest that money somehow within Russia. So that is a big benefit for Russia. That's that's one of the reasons why the Russian economy is growing so nicely.
You said that a huge chunk of Ukraine would be Russian. Do you consider Odessa, Nikolaev, these cities would be Russian?
Yes. The question is, what doesn't Russia want? And it's pretty certain that Russia doesn't want Western Ukraine, which was never part of Russia. It was added to the Soviet Union, and specifically to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, by Stalin after World War II. And if it goes away, then good riddance. The ideal is for it to become somebody else's problem, because it's full of people who are hostile to Russia. And the ideal plan would be to basically herd all of these people who have in the recent decades spread out from Western Ukraine to all over the place throughout former Ukraine, to herd them all back into Western Ukraine and shut the door forever. Basically, build a brick wall to keep them there as a sort of nature preserve. And so the question is, where does that wall go? Where will Russia decide, okay, here's our new border? It's very hard to tell at this point, but it all depends on how things go politically within the Ukraine. Because you see, Zelensky has canceled the elections. So the Ukraine is no longer a democracy. As of this month, he's an illegitimate president. He was not elected according to a constitution, any constitution. He's just basically someone who grabbed power. So suddenly his status, legal status, and Putin is very much a legalistic sort of mind. You know, he's a lawyer. His status goes from the elected representative of a sovereign nation to a war criminal, a terrorist, someone who needs to be destroyed, which is something that Russia does very well. That's a bit of Russian know-how. It basically destroyed the terrorists wherever it found them to a very good result, be it in Chechnya or in Syria or now in the Ukraine. So there may be some very hefty conventional bombs falling directly on Zelensky in the coming months, after which point the Ukraine will no longer have any sort of a federal structure.
You talk about Zelensky. We know that after that conflict between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, right now the foreign minister, Ukrainian foreign minister, has some disagreements with Zelensky. And we had the brother of mayor of Kiev talking about if we can replace Zaluzhny when we are at war with Russia, then of course we can replace Zelensky as well. How do you see these changes in Ukraine?
Well, you can replace anybody with anybody, but the crimes that they have already committed will follow them, even if they're replaced. And there's no statute of limitations on war crimes. And Putin has made it clear that war criminals will be hunted down and killed wherever they're found. So it's not like rearranging the deck chairs on that particular ship is going to do anybody any good. And I'm surprised that anybody at this point would even consider somehow, without any election, but through some mystical process, becoming the president, quote unquote, of the Ukraine, quote unquote.
The other thing that recently in the West they were talking about was the frozen Russian assets. And they are talking about sending them to Ukraine as an aid. There is no hope for Ukraine winning this war. How do you see this attempt on the part of the West? Why they're trying to do this?
Well, it's just itchy hands. You know, there's money there. Of course they want money. There was never any time in history when these Western countries weren't very eager to abscond with somebody's wealth. They talk about private property and state property and sovereign rights and all of that, but that all turns out to be nonsense, because they will, when it comes down to it, just steal the money. Now, giving that money to the Ukraine won't do any good, because the Ukrainians are extremely corrupt and will just pocket all of it. There isn't really weapons to buy with it, because the weapons manufacturing outside of Russia, China, a few other countries isn't keeping up. So there isn't really the cupboard is bare, and the arms industry in the West is sort of this boutique industry that was supposed to fight wars of choice against barbarians, if you will. Even that is not working, as we see in Yemen, as we saw in Afghanistan. But basically, these are boutique armies that are all for show. You know, they're like majorettes. They're good for parades, and not good for fighting a high intensity conventional war, which is what they what the situation in the Ukraine has turned into. So basically, it's pointless. What they're doing is quite pointless. And the other thing is that the amount of foreign wealth held in Russia far exceeds the amount of Russian wealth held in the West. And so if the West decides to confiscate Russian assets in the West, Russia will respond in exactly the same fashion, except it will very easily exceed the relatively paltry sums held in the West. And it is the West that's going to get hurt, not Russia. Russia doesn't really need that money. The West needs every cent it can get its grubby hands on at this point.
If the West finally decides to do that to Russia, what would be the message for China, for other countries?
Well, obviously, the message will be de-dollarize as quickly as possible. Get your money out of Western institutions. Come up with some new way to manage finances internationally. Do not trust Western banks and financial institutions. That is the obvious message. So basically, the all of these Western financial institutions, by absconding with Russia's sovereign wealth, are sowing through a branch on which they're perched. They're basically they're engineering their own undoing by doing so.
One of the countries that is so important in the Middle East for the United States is Saudi Arabia. And they have been playing both sides. And how do you see the future of this country? Do you think they're going toward the East?
Well, the interesting events will unfold when the fracking phenomenon in the United States starts to run its course. It's on a plateau right now. And production there is becoming increasingly expensive, but the United States still outproduces every other oil-producing country in the world. Unfortunately, that oil is of a grade that is not useful for making diesel and jet fuel and bunker fuel, which are key economic ingredients. And the United States, in spite of producing something like 13 million barrels of oil a day, is forced to import heavy oil wherever it can find it. Russia, Venezuela, I tried to get some oil from. So basically, it's simultaneously the world's largest oil producer and a bit of a beggar. Now, when it turns into a real beggar, and you have to keep in mind that the United States, it is very, very inefficient when it comes to the use of fossil fuel energy, mostly because of the society on wheels and the fact that it relies on an international highway system and trucking, and just the way the whole place is built up, and lots of little houses, lots of little ticky-tacky houses that are expensive to heat. All of that added together means that the United States basically burns through a lot more fossil fuels per unit GDP than any country on earth. It's the most ridiculously inefficient country on earth when it comes to energy. So when its own energy bounty starts to decline, where is it going to go to get the oil that it will desperately need to keep its economy running on any level whatsoever? Well, at that point, it may turn out that other major producers such as Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, are far more interested in trading with countries other than the United States and will not sell oil to the United States for dollars. The United States will have two options: going without and somehow finding an honest way to earn foreign revenue because the US dollar will no longer be accepted. And that will be a very interesting situation. And that is what Saudi Arabia is shooting for. It is selling oil for yuan. It has joined BRICS, and it's cementing ties with countries around the world to escape from its unbearably close relationship with the United States.
What's the plan for Europe? What's the future of Europe? How do you understand their behavior? What's your take on their behavior?
Well, it's not rational, but on the other hand, they're not making their own decisions. Basically, the European leadership is a bunch of puppets. They get their orders from Washington, and if they don't follow those orders, they're replaced pretty quickly. There's any number of ways to involve them in some sort of an engineered scandal and just get rid of them. So that they basically they just follow the script. Now the script is semi-suicidal. So for instance, all of the new energy initiatives, the clean, supposedly clean energy, has misfired. None of that energy is renewable because all of the stuff that they installed works for maybe a decade, maybe a little more, and then it needs to be replaced. Replaced by whom? By Chinese manufacturers? Well, maybe not. At the same time, they've ruined their traditional energy infrastructure to a point that they're now deindustrializing rapidly. And I guess that was the plan, because the United States doesn't want competitors. Now, it has competitors that it can't touch, such as China. It really can't do anything about China, but it can do something about Europe. So basically, the United States is destroying whatever it can destroy, whatever it can get its hands on. So now it's destroying European industry, thinking that that will make things better for American industry. Of course, that doesn't really work either, because Americans don't have the skilled personnel anymore to run industry, to run large scale industry, and the situation will only get worse because of the horrible educational system in the United States. So that is really what's happening, and I think what will happen to Western Europe is destitution, just poverty, destitution, and political instability.
I remember once Antony Blinken was asked why the sanctions are not working on Russia. He said that the world is changing and we have to study this new world. Do you think that the United States has already started to study the new world and these changes, huge changes that are happening right now?
Well, I think it has limited ability to study this new world. Look at how it completely missed the situation in Yemen and the Red Sea and Suez Canal. Look at how it messed up the situation in the Ukraine. And how it can't possibly maneuver its way through that. The best brain it had as far as Russia was Victoria Nuland. How pathetic is that? And so the Americans really don't have a good grasp on reality at this point. They have wishes, they want to impose these wishes on the rest of the world, but they no longer have the ability to do so. So they try again and again and again, and the situation is becoming increasingly disaster prone and embarrassing for them. And I think that that's going to continue until they give up their ambitions of dominating other countries, countries outside their borders.
One of the things that has happened recently was this replacement of Victoria Nuland. It seems that they are shifting the focus from Russia to China. Do you think that in the region, finally, they're getting to the point that Ukraine case is gone, is lost, and let's focus on China?
They have to keep the Ukraine conflict alive because their theory is that it distracts Russia from helping China. That's their brilliant idea. So there's a 1,000-kilometer front that's active in the Ukraine, but that's not really working. You know, that front is starting to crumble. So their plan now is to open up another front, a few more hundred kilometers in the north, in the Kharkov and Sumy regions, thinking that that will get Russia, keep Russia preoccupied with the Ukraine a bit longer, long enough for them to somehow, I guess, prepare to go to war against China or get something or other going with regard to Taiwan, or something will happen. Because their nightmare is what they're seeing is that Russia is outproducing militarily every other country on Earth. It is pioneering new weapons development faster than anyone else, including AI-enabled drones and things like that that nobody has. It has weapons that can penetrate any defense system anywhere. So it's a formidable foe at this point, and nobody really wants to go to war against Russia. Now, if Russia and China join forces, then that becomes completely just an entirely invincible combination. And so what they're hoping for is that they'll manage to somehow bog Russia down in fighting in the Ukraine, maybe by throwing more foreign mercenaries at it, maybe by getting European militaries involved, although the only ones that seem ready to do it are the French so far. A few Romanians, quite a few Poles, and of course, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are militarily oh so powerful and are willing to sacrifice their young men for no reason. But that's not doing it. That's not doing it. So it's not clear what the United States will do, but right now the plan is certainly whatever it takes, no matter how many Ukrainians get killed for no apparent reason, just keep the Ukrainian war lit for a little bit longer, just so that it's a distraction from what's happening between Russia and China. That's not working either.
If Trump wins, do you think that would bring China and Russia even closer, or that would distance Russia from China?
Trump can win the presidency, but he can't win as a president. That is what happened during his first term. Is he got into office and the deep state said, "What? No, this won't work," and basically thwarted him no matter what he tried to do, and started all kinds of dirty campaigns, trying to get him impeached and smear his name and whatever else. So he didn't manage to accomplish very much. And so this will probably happen again because the deep state hasn't gone anywhere. And Trump is just an interloper. The deep state is happy with the cryptic Biden administration, where nobody even knows who's part of it and who's calling the shots, because it's obviously not Biden. The deep state loves the Biden administration. That's why all of this corruption that the Bidens have been involved with, basically it's just Teflon and they skate right on through, doesn't stick. Whereas Trump gets hauled through the courts and fined ridiculous sums of money for things he may or may not be guilty of, just because the entire system opposes him. And that's not going to change. So basically, we'll see one. If Trump wins, we'll see one completely ineffective U.S. president replaced with another completely ineffective U.S. president.
Recently, Chuck Schumer said that the day of Netanyahu has come and we have to have a new election in Israel. How do you see the U.S. foreign policy in Israel right now?
Well, the Netanyahu administration and his entire coalition have gone off the deep end. They're basically people whose hand nobody wants to shake. There's some inertia within within the U.S. government, so that it's very hard to stop giving support to Israel. There's institutional inertia. But not giving support to the Netanyahu regime is something that they are all willing to do at this point for political reasons, for political gains, for posturing, because he looks so bad. And the other thing is that he's unelectable at this point in Israel. His popularity is very, very, very low. And so he finds himself in the same situation as Zelensky. If he cancels the elections, then he becomes just a war criminal and not an elected leader of a nation. And you know what's done to terrorists? They're killed. You know, Putin was the one who coined who quipped that, you know, our job is to send the terrorists to Allah and let Allah decide what to do with them. And so basically his life expectancy becomes very short if he cancels democracy in Israel. If he doesn't cancel democracy in Israel, then he's out of a job and possibly in jail. So that's basically his future. And seeing that that's his future, everybody is trying to distance themselves from him as much as possible.
When you look at Israel right now, we know that the vast majority of Israelis are supporting the policy in Gaza, but it seems, on the other hand, this could be a manufactured behavior on the part of the Netanyahu administration for years, because they have been in power for years and they shaped this kind of behavior in Israel. Do you think if some changes happen in Israel, that would bring some sort of changes in their region, in their policy, considering the situation in Gaza?
Well, you don't easily go from slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people over a period of decades and then say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I'll be nice to you now and expect things to calm down and be reasonable. I think that Israel has basically sealed its fate, starting with Nakba way back when. And I think that, you know, although some people might think that Israel still has some legitimacy, if you look at it from a strictly legal perspective, Israel does not have the right to exist. Nobody has ever given it that right. And so if it goes away, if it disappears, that would be the expected thing.
Do you find these Arab states in favor of changing Netanyahu and his administration? How do they see this policy of the United States?
To be honest, I don't know, but I don't expect any miracles. The Arab leaders always talk. They're great talkers. But when it comes to collective action, they're not very good at it. Haven't been in many centuries, perhaps some, you know, I don't know how many centuries, but basically it's a lot of different countries who speak different dialects of Arabic, who don't necessarily understand each other all that well. Basically they're disunited by a common language, you might say, and each one pursues its own path. And is not very eager to collaborate with even its close neighbors, never mind Arab states in other parts of the world. So I don't expect any miracles there. They protest a lot. You know, there are a lot of street protests, but I expect a lot more action to come from non-state entities of various kinds. So. So look what the Yemenis are doing. Look at what the action in southern Lebanon, various other groups of Islamic or Islamic minded people who are basically taking matters into their own hands. And given the advances in modern warfare, with a lot of drones, a lot of rockets being used, a lot of precision rockets now available to pretty much anybody who wants them, they can do quite a lot of damage to Israel, much more than actual governments that are afraid to enter into an actual hot conflict with Israel because they're not that powerful.